Hey, Gene, how you doing?
Well, I'm not in the hospital, so I got that going for me.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Camelot 3000 on Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and if we're covering Camelot 3000, that means we have our expert on the table round, Mr. Gene Hendricks, here with us. How's it going, Gene?
Going all right, Paul. I'm glad to be back talking some early 80s Camelot books.
I am telling you right now, this is killing me. I've read this. It's not that I never read it, but I don't remember how it all plays out. And I am limiting myself to reading two issues at a time because that's what we're covering. And I finished the two issues, and they are quick reading. I am not going to say that, you know, these take me very long to read, but they're satisfying because they're quick, but they're meaty. But I want to desperately go on to the next issue, but I'm holding off because I'm only reading them as we're recording.
Yeah, it's interesting. I got to the end of issue 9, and I remembered the revelation, and it comes at the very end of the issue. I'm like, oh, Paul is just dying, isn't he?
Absolutely, I'm dying.
I'm dying again!
That's what I feel like. We just found out that Camelot 3000 is in Hoboken. And for the big Bugs Bunny fans in the audience, you'll know what that reference means. So I guess we might as well jump in. We're doing issues 8 and 9 today. The plan, just so that everybody knows, we're doing 8 and 9 today. Next time we're going to do 10 and 11, and then we're going to wrap up the whole series with one episode and one issue, which will be issue number 12.
The big blowout.
There are two more episodes to follow this one. But for now, let's revel in the joy that is issues 8 and 9.
All right. Well, jumping right into issue number 8, it was cover dated July 1983. The on-sale date was April 7th, 1982. Story by Mike W. Barr. Brian J. Bolland was your penciler. Inks by Terry Austin. Letters by John Costanza. Colors by Tatiana Wood, and your editor was Len Wein. On the cover of this issue, we have Arthur pointing Excalibur at the shocked Round Table Knights. Inside, we start with our title, Judas Knights, over the hand of Morgan, placing a talisman with the combined male and female emblem into the hand of Tristan. Tristan holds it up, not quite believing what he's seeing. As Morgan leaves, Tristan gets a really creepy smile on his face as he contemplates being in a male body again. Outside, we see that Percival has overheard what's going on, but the mute knight has also been observed by a shadowy figure. In the throne room, Kay tries to get Arthur to come out of his depression, but is unsuccessful. Elsewhere, Gawain and Galahad are playing cards and generally complaining that something needs to be done about the king. Guinevere and Lancelot are in Paris at the Futrelle headquarters, which looks really structurally unstable to my engineering brain, dealing with the alien advance by taking in more refugees. Kay has gone to Merlin for help, even though in matters of the heart are beyond the wizard's experience. But he agrees to try. Kay follows Merlin back out of his chamber as Morgan and, presumably, Tristan enter. The intruders destroy a pyramid, freeing Nieve. The former Lady of the Lake immediately interrupts Merlin's attempt to bring Arthur to his senses. Merlin, captured by his love for her, leaves, pleading for Arthur to remember the talismans. Arthur, on the warpath, enters Merlin's chamber with Kay to find Tristan kneeling over the broken pyramid. He says that Arthur doesn't understand. Later, Galahad returns with Lancelot and Guinevere, who joined the rest of the round table to see Tristan being accused of betraying them all. Morgan and Jordan Matthew watch the proceedings, even though Arthur knows that someone is observing them. Tristan claims that he intended to betray the Round Table, but the damage was already done when he arrived. Arthur hands Tristan Excalibur, saying that someone speaking falsely while holding it will die. Tristan takes the sword and repeats his admission, passing Arthur's test. Then Galahad, Lancelot, and Guinevere all pass the test. And then Arthur comes to Kay, who refuses to take the sword. Kay eventually admits that he helped Morgan, but thought that Merlin would be able to resist. Arthur pronounces sentence, which is death. Lancelot argues that Kay did what he thought was right for the Round Table, but Arthur is adamant that his brother will die. Back at the UN, Morgan and Matthew are planning, which happens to lock out Isolde, who is feeling isolated. Morgan shows that her troops have come close to New Camelot. As Kay is about to lose his head, the aliens attack. Everyone retreats, and Arthur drops the talisman Tristan was given. Guinevere attempts to call in reinforcements, but Morgan destroys her communicator. The knights return fire as Percival does his best trebuchet impression and hurls a boulder through several ships. Kay attempts to escape, but seeing Kamikaze heading for Arthur, both Kay and Tom run to Arthur's aid, with Kay taking the brunt of a laser blast. Arthur destroys the ship, but Tom is injured and Kay is dead. Tom tells Arthur to keep fighting, and Lancelot explains to Arthur that the radiation Tom absorbed will kill him. There is no cure. Arthur, however, knows of a cure, the Holy Grail. Hearing about the Grail, Morgan calls off the attack. Jordan Matthew is angry, but Morgan explains that the Grail could heal even her condition. In the infirmary, Tom argues that he is not important enough to bother with, especially if it means giving up the battle against the aliens. Arthur explains that the Knights of the Round Table take care of their own, which includes the newly knighted Sir Thomas. Tristan has retrieved the talisman and vows to kill Morgan with his bare hands, if Morgan reneges on their agreement. Later, Arthur mourns his brother, and Lancelot suggests that he ask Excalibur for help. Arthur then admits that he made up the truth-telling properties of the sword, but Kay did not know that. So we have a Corbomite maneuver.
Yeah, oh yeah. I didn't make that connection, but absolutely. So now, first question. Was Tristan actually prepared to betray them and didn't because Kay got to it first?
That's the way it seems, yeah.
So it's not that Tristan was, thought better of the actions. It's just that he got beat to the punch.
Right, but he's completely so honest. He said, no, I was ready to betray all you, but...
Yeah, exactly. So, it does bring into question Tristan's, loyalty, and not even loyalty, his character, which there's one particular panel in the next issue that really makes me question that even more so.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that next when we talk about the next issue.
Eventually.
'Cause up till now, I've kind of felt that Tristan was above it all. And again, I don't remember what happened. I can't believe I've read this before because I don't remember things. But I was fully anticipating that Tristan would be ready to betray them and then say, no, I can't do that.
You would think that, but Tristan has never accepted being in a woman's body. And then all of us, and we saw that in the one issue where he was, I, as much as I hate this, I cannot betray my brothers, etc. As the second his love shows up, all that's out the window. It's like, okay, if I want to be with her, I need this body. Give me the amulet.
No, I understand the temptation of Tristan. That's not throwing me off at all. But I am being thrown off by the fact that Tristan is ready to fully give in to the temptation Like I said, I keep feeling that at the last second it's going to be no. I'm too honorable to do this, and yet this is showing us kind of maybe not so much.
Yeah, but that goes back to Mallory too. It's the something that I don't know if it carries over or what's going on because it was magic. It might, but when Tristan and Isolde drank that love potion, that was it. That was I will have my honor until. Mm-hmm. So Tristan has betrayed his trust or other people's trust in him before simply for Isolde. So that's good on Mike W. Barr going back and knowing all that, but also it reflects on what Morgan was planning on. It's like, okay, I'll tempt you. I'll give you this. Oh, you're refusing me? Well, I have this ace in the hole. Bang, here. So it does actually mesh up. So I don't have a problem with it.
Oh, it's not that I have a problem with it. It's just...
I know.
You know, this when you read these books, and I admit to a certain amount of romanticism, naivete, heroism, whatever you want to call it. But I look for my heroes in the books to be above all that.
Right.
And mm-hmm. in this instance, you know, Tristan is showing no. You know, and it's weird because when I critique these books, I usually say, you know, I want to see that these people are more human and that they, you know, that they have foibles just like anybody else. But when push comes to shove, when everything is on the line, I want to see them rise above it and be heroic. And
yes,
that's where
agree.
I'm let down because I thought Tristan was that type of character. So I feel let down because he's not being heroic here. He's allowing temptation to take over.
Yeah, and that's a failure of every Arthurian knight with one exception. The only perfect knight is Galahad. And that's why originally he's the one that achieved the Grail Quest.
Right. Okay, and you know, it is true to the story. It's just, you know, we're reading comics, and I have a comic book sensibility about me, for better or for worse. Now, Kay being the betrayer did not... It shocked me, but it did not seem out of character, because he betrayed them in an effort to help them. He was just misguided as opposed to selfish.
Right. He specifically says that he wanted to show Arthur that if Merlin was betrayed, then it would make Arthur do something, not just sit and wallow in pity anymore. But like he said, he thought that Merlin would be able to resist, forgetting the fact that he wasn't able to resist her before, which is why he got stuck in Stonehenge.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because I assume you know a little of that history that I don't.
So, in basically every single version of the Arthurian tale, Arthur has Merlin when Arthur's young, and Merlin's his teacher. And hey, this is how you can be a good ruler. You need to look out for this, etc. He's not able to protect Arthur a lot, and I'll get more into that in the next issue. But at some point, there comes a time when Merlin is taken away from Arthur. Whether that's in the Disney version, where he gets so frustrated that he just goes for a vacation in Bermuda, or in, like what this is saying in Mallory, now you see, the Lady of the Lake is a title, it's not a person. And this lady here was one of the Ladies of the Lake. And she, Nineveh is her name, and she was not entirely pleased with the Christian God coming in and replacing the pagan stuff. And she saw Merlin as kind of someone who had betrayed the ancient order of things. So she ended up seducing him, and depending on where you go, he's either locked in a crystal cave, he's, in this version, he's stuck under Stonehenge, but she gets him out of the way at some point, and Arthur is left without an advisor. Presumably because that she thinks, oh, well, without Merlin, he's just going to completely go downhill. And it kind of sort of works, but Arthur, he sticks around for another, like, 40-odd years as king, so I don't know how good it worked, but it, you know, he does tend to make most of his bad decisions without Merlin there.
Okay, I mean, that's so, I wasn't sure, you see, I was unfamiliar with the whole dynamic of the Lady of the Lake, that I just thought it was one person and that was that. I didn't realize that it was just a title. Okay, that all makes sense. So now I don't have a lot of notes on this. I just, you know, most of my notes are just like ooh and ah. But you know, I love the fact that they go into the Holy Grail now, that that's become the new quest. And I also really liked and totally forgot that he knights Tom.
Yeah, and I'm actually a little bit surprised that it took this long, really, because Tom has been around since issue one. But it does make sense that, oh, well, you've been fighting alongside us. You might as well, you know, be an official member of the group now. So
it does make sense.
Yeah.
But it's not, at least it's from, you know, from my perspective, it's not an honor that he bestows lightly upon anyone. So therefore, you know, Tom as a teenager, you know, is rising above other people at his station to a great extent by being knighted at this point. You know, this isn't a rock star becoming a sir so-and-so. This is somebody who's part of the fighting, you know, team for the Table Round, and you know, it's as best as I can see it, it's a huge honor, and I think it is well deserved, because I think he's shown himself to be worthy.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I mean, he's been there through thick and thin, and you know, he sacrificed himself to try and save Arthur. So, you know, it's you can't really get a much better recommendation than that, you know, someone who is completely selfless in that sense. And in fact, he basically, when Arthur's taking him off the battlefield, he goes, leave me alone, go keep fighting.
Yeah. And then the only note I have, which is extremely superficial, is when Isolde shows up at Matthew's office, and just the outfit she's wearing. I mentioned in previous episodes, I get a kick out of what artists determine is appropriate garb for the future, and that one seems particularly weird with these long puffy sleeves and basically what appears to be either like a bikini bottom or a something of that ilk, and then a garter tied around her leg.
Yeah, so you don't like clown chic. Yeah,
exactly. And you top
because she's got the big puffy sleeves. Yeah, she's got the puffy sleeves. She's got the ruffled collar, two big puffy buttons on the top. It looks like she mugged a clown and took his shirt.
Just in a little things on that same page. When we have the inset of Morgan Le Fay and Jordan Matthews, and just a little detail is, you know, Morgan's creature, which is formerly apparently a person, like just on the table, and it's just kind of like, I don't know if it's twitching or if it's laughing or what it's doing, but it just, I don't know, just a really nice touch. I thought it just stood out to me.
Yeah, it's doing something strange, and that I think part of what it's doing, if you look at the papers on the floor, it's just messing up Jordan's desk. It's just, oh, fun, let's throw this on the floor, crumple it up.
Yeah, well, that's what character seems to me to be, just kind of an imp.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I don't have too many notes. The next issue is when I have a lot of notes. But this one, it moves the story forward. You know, yet again, we're following the same basic cycle as the original stories. It's okay, you know, Arthur gets betrayed by Lancelot and Guinevere. He mopes for a while. Something big happens to stir him out of that. Merlin gets betrayed and is gone. We got to find this the Grail, and let's get going. So yeah, everything is happening again. So like I said way back when we covered the first issue, if you're familiar with the Arthurian story, nothing here will necessarily be a surprise, because it's all going to happen again. Yeah. Although the end of the next issue can be a surprise, depending on how you're looking at it.
Oh, it's there for me. Because nothing should be a surprise, because I've read this in the past. But, you know, what can I tell you? The other thing about this that that was, I think, telling and really well, like a nice thing that's planted here. You know, we talk about how in the progression of a story, you know, you need to make the odds seem so high against you, or the ultimate victory is not going to be as satisfying. And here, if he hadn't mentioned the Holy Grail, Morgan would not have pulled the troops back, and Arthur would have been defeated here. This would have been the end.
Yeah.
You know, she basically had them, but she wants the Holy Grail because she wants it to cure her back knee.
And it completely shocks Jordan. It's like, oh wait, what?
That she pulled back. Yes.
Yeah, he's what. We were going to win. What are you doing? And then, you know, again, she's being selfish. It's like, I can cure myself when they do this, so I'm going to leave off certain victory and snatch this healing thing from them when they find it.
Is it total selfishness, or is it ego, where she thinks, well, you know what, I'm going to win this anyway, so I can win it now, or I can wait and win it later after my back is healed?
There is that, but an admission that she gives us in the next issue is that her power isn't coming back as fast, so she needs the Grail probably in order to win next time, because she may not have the power again at that point.
Well, it's a kind of a catch-22 going.
Yeah. Shall we rate this?
Just before we do that, one more point is just, I just want to mention again that the art is outstanding. A lot of nice touches. The close-up of Tom's face when Arthur knights him, very, very cool looking. And the shot of Arthur knighting him with the sword, you know, the perspective of the sword looking so large and everything. Just really good stuff. And all of the knights behind him taking a knee. Just outstanding. And yeah, can we rate this? Yeah, A.
Yep. Yeah, I'm going to give the cover an A+, because that is one heck of an image. Very simple. You got all the knights, Arthur's pointing the sword at him, and then you see Arthur's reflection in the pommel. So you have everyone represented. It looks terrific. And I just love Tom's face, like, who, me?
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
But yeah, A plus for that. A's across the board. It's yet another great issue.
I'm going to agree totally. I'm also going to agree with the A+ on the cover, and the A's that the story and the artwork inside get are perilously close to A+s. They could easily be rated that way.
Yeah, there are a couple panels on the art that's like, maybe not. But yeah, it's very, very close.
So moving on to issue number 9. And if you're listening to this, I hope you're getting sad that we're getting close to the end, because it makes me sad. As yes. Doing it, I just want this to go on and on. Anyway, number 9 has a cover date of December of 1983. The cover is by Brian Bolland again, and the creative team is the same as we've had the last two issues. The cover depicts a close-up of Sir Percival with his hands surrounding the Holy Grail, which is bathing him in a golden light. Chapter 9 is titled Grail Quest 3000. This chapter opens with Lancelot standing vigil outside of what appears to be an ornate entrance to a chapel. Arthur approaches him, and they discuss the fact that Percival has been inside praying since Arthur announced that they would be seeking the Holy Grail. Meanwhile, Guinevere is seated at Tom's bedside when Arthur and Lancelot enter. Tom feels himself dying and momentarily regrets taking the blast for Arthur and then apologizes for saying it in the first place. He questions the existence of the Grail, and Arthur provides him with a history of the holy artifact, how Christ drank from it at the Last Supper, and how it served as a vessel to collect his blood at the crucifixion. It is said that Joseph of Arimathea took the Grail from the Holy Land and that its location is unknown. We then see Percival praying and literally sweating blood before leaving the chapel. At the round table, Arthur is ready to impart his strategy as Morgan Le Fay and Jordan eavesdrop, but Tristan presents a talisman of Merlin's, which prevents them from doing so. At this point, Jordan shows some unexpected backbone and demands a price to continue helping Morgan. He demands that she reveal his part in the scheme, and she douses him with some red dust that revives his memory. Jordan, you see, is also resurrected from a past life. We see him as an infant taken by his mother, Queen Margose, I don't know how to pronounce that, and you'll correct me later, and given to a peasant woman. That woman was intercepted by Arthur and two of his men. And so while Sir Tristan has his way with the woman, and that's the panel I was talking about last issue, as Arthur takes the infant and submerges it in a lake. According to Jordan's narration, he thought the baby was dead and left it to be buried along with other male babies that were killed. But he wasn't dead and was taken by the peasant woman, and now his memories of this having been restored, and he is revealed as Modred, the bastard son of Arthur, who was prophesied to be a threat to his throne. And Morgan tells him that he can slay Arthur, but she gets the planet. He agrees, but clearly is not loyal to her in his own private thoughts. Arthur divides his forces into two groups. Lancelot, Commander Acton, Sir Percival, and Sir Tom are to search for the Grail. Arthur, Tristan, Galahad, and Gawain will be attempting to free Merlin. In bidding each other farewell, Tom asks if Tristan would rather accompany them to see if he can be fixed by the Grail, which he declines. Arthur bids Tom farewell, embracing him and calling him son. Guinevere attempts to tell Arthur that she is sorry, and he responds by saying that they can't change the past, but can try for a better future. As they take off, he says to himself that he too is sorry. As the second group leaves, Tristan thinks that if they find Morgan Le Fay, her spells can release her from... This group lands in Glastonbury, where Percival follows a vision. He beats down two aliens and enters a cave. There, amidst a blinding light, they confront the guardian of the Grail. He presents Percival with a choice of forms, one of which houses the Grail. Lancelot implores him to choose a crucifix, but he picks a simple box, which then transforms into the Grail. It cures Tom and also converts Percival back to human form, where he is freed and transcends to the afterlife. Lancelot is declared the new guardian of the Grail, and as they leave, they're confronted by more aliens, and the Grail is taken from him, failing in his duty as the guardian. It's delivered to Modred, who then tells Morgan that he will be giving the orders from now on. To be continued. And it took me nearly as much self-control and willpower to keep from reading the next issue as it probably takes Lancelot and Guinevere to keep apart.
Yeah, but you succeeded.
I said, not quite as much, maybe.
Yeah.
So
this one has a whole lot of stuff in it.
Well, I guess the first order of business is to ask you to see how much of this for us less knowledgeable people you can tie into the true legends.
Okay, so the story of the Grail, that's the story of the Grail. That's historic. That's not Arthurian specific. Mordred. Okay. So Arthur had three older sisters. Morgause, the lady pictured here, was the wife. She eventually became the wife of King Lot. She is also the mother of Gawain. Now, when Arthur first became king, no one knew what his parentage was. Because you have to remember, Merlin took him as a baby. He was raised by Sir Ector, and comes when he's 15, hence boy king, and frees the sword from the stone. Therefore, he is king. But they don't know that Uther is his father, and why am I blanking on her name? Igraine is his mother. So in order to be political and such like that, Morgause goes and seduces the new king and sleeps with him, begetting Mordred, who Lot believes is his own son. Now, later on, they find out Merlin prophesies, hey, something's wrong here. You don't know who this woman was that you slept with. I know a kid will come from that. That kid will be a threat. So Merlin comes up with the bright idea of, hey, you know that Pharaoh guy? He had a really great plan. Let's kill all the firstborn. Essentially, all the kids born on May Day, or around then, all those sons have to be sacrificed in order to assure Arthur's rule. And yes, Arthur goes along with it. There wasn't any of this Tristan rapes somebody, Arthur physically drowns the kids. No, they were all put on a ship. Ship was sent away. We don't know what was going to happen, because that's not discussed, but the ship ends up sinking. And Mordred has been found as the only survivor, and brought back to King Lot and raised with his brothers. So they find out after Mordred is an adult and already a Knight of the Round Table that Arthur is in fact his father. And that kind of breaks Mordred's brain. Because, you know, his life has been a lie up to this. He's not a Scottish prince. He's the bastard son of the king. Oh, what's going on here? And so he ends up trying to overthrow Arthur, and is the one that actually, at the final battle of Camlann, I believe, is when Arthur faces off with Mordred. Mordred has Excalibur, and Arthur has a spear. Arthur runs him through, and Mordred hits Arthur in the head, hence the wound you see in issue one of this series. But Mordred's just, in general, not a nice person.
Now, one of the things I did in my headcanon to try and maintain a heroic view of the knights is to think, this is Mordred's perspective of what happened and his belief of what happened, and maybe Tristan didn't really rape this peasant girl. So right. That's how I get by that you know, he wants impart upon them, you know, as much evil as he can to justify his own vendetta.
I perfectly agree that's because none of that really matches up. You know, Arthur wasn't going around drowning babies.
And I'm thankful for that. yes. because I want to root for Arthur in this. And I already have,
right, yeah.
I've already given you, you know, reason that you could question Tristan's character slightly. I don't want to tarnish it more, and I don't want to question Arthur, you know. So putting them on a boat and sending them off to some foreign island where they could live out their lives among in the land of lollipops and daisies is much more much more palatable to me.
Right. Now on to the second half of the lore dump, and that would be the Grail, or specifically in this case, the Fisher King. The vision that Percival sees, who happens to be his uncle, is an old man who's walking with a cane. Why is he walking with a cane? Well, it's because he was injured. This is the Fisher King, the guardian of the Grail. When he was younger, this king was rather prideful, didn't exactly want to be a chaste Christian knight. He ended up getting into a jousting match with another knight, and he killed that knight, but was wounded in the, and air quotes up to the mic, thigh, which is medieval double entendre. Really, it's a code word for the groin, but they couldn't say that in Mallory. So what, he is the guardian of the Grail because he is contrite now. He is very apologetic. He is, you know, I realize I was wrong, etc. And he has been prophesied to not be healed until a heroic knight of his lineage comes to him and asks, "What ails thee?" However, way back then, the rules of hospitality basically said, you don't pry into your host's business. So Percival, through many adventures, eventually came to the Grail Castle, met the Fisher King, had a feast with him, never once asked the question. Which is why Percival did not achieve the Grail Quest. Galahad did. And when Galahad achieved the Grail Quest, he did what needed to be done with the Grail, and then, like Percival in this, ascended to heaven. Bodily ascended to heaven. So we have the same guardian who knows Percival, and Percival is finally, by achieving the quest here, able to correct his mistake, which is also why the Fisher King isn't allowed to leave and not be the Grail Guardian anymore, and passes it on to Lancelot.
Okay, and I guess you don't have to accept it. It just gets thrust upon you, because there's never a point where Lancelot says, yes, I will be the Guardian of the Grail.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's basically, you're it.
Yeah, but it almost seems
truly,
like...
I was going to say, if you're a Christian knight, being told, hey, you're the new Grail Guardian, that's like the ultimate.
And yet it doesn't feel like that when I'm reading this, because it seems to me, you know, from this and from like the Guardian of the Grail in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, it seems like if you are the Guardian, you are now tied to the place of the Grail, and that you stay there and you guard it, and that's it. That is now your role in life or in being. That's the way the Guardian seems when we come upon him in here. That's the way the Guardian seems when Indiana Jones comes upon him. And yet, you know, Lancelot is, yeah, I'll throw this, you know, tie this onto my backpack and I'll carry it along with me as if it's, you know, a canteen. Like, it doesn't feel like he's dedicating his existence to it the way you... be with you with Mindy. Is that fair, or am I being unfair here?
No, I think that's perfectly fair. However, the Grail did appear with a rope tied around it already.
So it's like the glove. So it's like the rail is telling you, yeah, you could just take.
Yeah, let's go. Let's wander off.
I'm bored here.
But yeah. What I really like though is I don't know how much of this was Barr, how much of this was Bolland, but the six emblems that show up as possibilities of where the Grail is. You have the traditional crucifix. You have a cube. And that's what Percival picks, because a cube, if you unfold all six sides, becomes a cross. But then the other four emblems, you have the all-seeing eye pyramid. Just look at the back of your $1 bill if you're confused what that is, which is an emblem of the Illuminati. You have an Ankh, which is the Egyptian symbol of resurrection. You have the compass and square of, and doesn't have the G in the middle, but that's the emblem of the Masons. And then you have a pagan emblem. The face surrounded by leaves is the Green Man, a very important god of the Celtic pantheon. So this is a wonderful array of possibilities that you have here as to what, you know, where could the Grail actually be? And like I said, I don't know if because obviously two of them Barr had to write in. But the other four, was that Barr? Was that Bolland saying, hey, yeah, there are four, you know, Barr telling them there are four other emblems, do something. But I love the choices here.
As do I. And I wish, I mean, it's obviously, yes, because everybody should change their history for my wish for fictional writing. But, I kind of wish there was some sort of corresponding artifact for each of these other beliefs that could be viewed as being the Holy Grail, and that this way it covers all religion, not just Christianity. But then that's kind of a silly wish, because the Grail is directly tied into Christ with him, you know, at the Last Supper and on the cross. So therefore it has to be tied into Christianity.
Yeah. Now, I don't know much about the Illuminati, the Egyptian religion, or the Masons at all. I do know a little bit about the Celtic stuff, mainly tangential to the Arthurian stuff, and they do have something that is fairly equivalent to the Grail. It's essentially the Black Cauldron. If any of you remember that long forgotten Disney movie from the 80s, but they have a cauldron which is able to produce vast quantities of food to resurrect the dead, etc. A lot of the same stuff you typically associate with the Arthurian Grail stories. So, you know, you have on the left side, you have the Christian version, and the right side, you have the Celtic version. There might be something in the middle. I just don't know enough about them.
And as I said, everybody should change their religious beliefs to comply with my need for fictional writing. Need for comic books. I just, you know, I don't have a lot of critique here. Most of my critique is, boy, this is well done. I even, you know, again, I'm going to just go off on the art a little bit. Tom's wounds, when they're shown close up, they really, I was going to say they look good, but the thing is they look horrific, but they feel real. And that's there's something to be said for that, because I've seen so many artistic versions of injuries that look so almost silly, that this is just, you know, there's something to be said for having an ability to convey that. The religious scenes are really well drawn. You know, the stuff with the Arthurian legend and the baby. You know, Jordan Matthews, when he realizes what's going on, or all the looks of anguish on his face. I'm going to say, as hard as it is for this to be true, the art in this book is a step up from the last issue. And the last issue was excellent. We gave A's to the last issue.
Yeah.
You know, just
yeah, I
everything
agree.
About it.
I mean, there, the recreations of, like you said, of The Last Supper from Da Vinci, wonderful. The chapel that's there is amazingly well done. Very detailed doorway. I'm sure it's referenced from something, but it doesn't look it. You know, it doesn't look like he's traced that. It looks like he's drawing it just using something as a guide. It is all really good. And yeah, Tom's injuries, they look like what I would assume radiation burns look like.
Exactly.
It's not, you know, bubbling wounds or anything. His flesh is, it's almost like Two-Face in The Dark Knight. Not quite to that extent, but it's burns. It's into his flesh. It doesn't look like something got put over it. Although later they make him look like Valance the Hunter from Star Wars.
Morgan Le Fay, when she's looking through the alien, you know, seeing what's going on through the alien's vision, mm-hmm. which is, I didn't mention, that's kind of like her workaround to get by the talisman that Tristan used to keep her from seeing, until that alien takes a shot in the back, and then and she feels the pain because she's looking through his eyes. That's all really well done. Just like the alien, and then seeing kind of her eyes floating above it, in a monochromatic, reddish drawing as opposed to black and white. Mm-hmm. Just so much stuff that's really just, you know, like as I said in the past, in the last issue, attention to detail is what seems to really bring this above. It's not the Todd McFarlane, oh, it looks so real. It's a different type of excellence. And it's, again, to me, it's the attention to detail and the ability to create an atmosphere. Those two things combined just bring this up to, you know, as high a level as I can see.
Yeah, it's the writing and art. I mean, this entire series, the writing and art have been top notch. But this one, and this is the issue that always sticks out in my mind, because of the Percival sequence in choosing the location of the Grail. And it's the sequence of him being
restored to his human form and then transcending to the afterlife.
Yes.
Just so it's like, you know, I mean, he's been, since he was transformed, he's been mute. And yet, in the issues that he's appeared, in the sequences he's appeared, through the art, through the storytelling, they've given him a dynamic personality and made him extremely likable. And I, at the same time, am saddened to see him leaving the story because he quickly became a favorite. And I'm happy for the character because, again, he's transcending into the light and moving on. So it's just to inspire those types of feelings in a comic book, it's not that easy.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is just terrific. As one of these things where, okay, last issue we lost Kay, this issue we lose Percival. We got three issues left. Who's next?
That's what it feels like. Absolutely. And I don't recall. We may lose nobody. We may lose everybody. We're going to see.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is there anything... Can you level one criticism on this issue? Anything?
Nope. None. No, this is basically a flawless issue.
Yeah, you know, I've talked about it more in reviewing movies than I have in reviewing comics. But in reviewing movies, I often say, you know, this is a perfect picture because it does everything it seeks to do and there's not a misstep in it. And sometimes that's with a movie that people wouldn't even think, oh, that's a great movie. because maybe its goals were not as epic as people might look for. Now, this, in my opinion, is a perfect comic. Everything about it. I'm giving it an A+ on all three levels, and it is epic. So I don't know how you can do much better than this, frankly. And I don't know why this isn't more well known as such an excellent series and issue. This is almost one you should probably see it on the as a wall comic in stores, because it's so good. And yet you could probably find it in a discount bin in certain places.
Yeah, which is really horrible when you think of it, you know. And I understand this is a niche title, you know, because you have to at least be interested in Arthurian stuff to think of picking it up. But oh wow, you really gotta everyone should read this. It, especially those in the comic industry. This is how you do it.
Yeah. And this might be, you know, there are other issues I would rate as highly as this, and I'm sure there have definitely been other issues that I have rated as high as this, but most of those are commonly thought of as some of the best books ever. This is one that I feel this way, and it's just kind of under the radar.
Yeah.
I could not be more satisfied with this issue. I'm just like looking, as I'm looking through it, just, you know, with Percival sweating the blood while he's praying, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, you know, what is he praying for? Is he praying for the release of his soul? Is he praying for the success of his band? Is he, you know, what exactly is he looking for? And that is left for you to kind of decide on your own, I believe. But
the vision he gets, that's another subtle piece of art, because, you know, he's sweating blood, and then all of a sudden a light is cast from the crucifix onto the wall showing Glastonbury Tor. But if you look at that first panel where the light is pushing the candle flame like it's been,
as if it's wind.
Like there's a breeze there. Yeah, it's just, it's so subtle. It's like, oh, wow, this is a physical effect that's going through. It's not just a projection.
And then the shot of baby Mordred under the water, and then the reverse shot of looking up at Arthur through the water, holding him down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrifying and beautiful at the same time. I can't say enough good things about the writing, the art, everything. Just tremendous. And it's hard for me not to have just read the next two issues. Next three issues.
Well, that just means we have to schedule a recording again very shortly so we can read the next two issues.
Yes, absolutely. So, do you vary off my thoughts at all of A pluses all around? Or
no, totally it is a 100% A+ book. And like I said, from when I first read this, this is the issue out of the entire series. This is the issue that stuck in my brain.
Okay, well, we'll see how closely they can come to matching this level of excellence the next time out, when we cover issues 10 and 11. Thanks, Gene, for making the time to do this. It's been enjoyable every step of the way.
Yes, and unfortunately, we are almost at the end now. I need to pick another series to torture you with.
Well, we're gonna do this now. Excuse me, it hasn't seen the light of day yet, but we are starting to do a retrospective on Disney animated movies, and obviously I'm going to be asking you to come on when we do Sword in the Stone, and we're going to also do Excalibur. So we'll be exploring more Arthurian legend with you.
All right. Well, hey, we can also cover Camelot while we're at it.
I think we may just do that, even though that's a very different take on it. But
a little bit.
Something to look forward to. I hope the listeners are enjoying this book as much as we are, and I hope books to look at, because listening to us talk about it, you know, that's all well and good. but actually reading the book's got to be better. So thank you everybody for listening.
If those of you who are listening have not read it, go and read it. Before we end this series, go and read it.
I definitely recommend that. And thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Gene, for coming on, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.